Good afternoon, and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. So did you catch the December news headline about Alaska FBI agents apprehending a global online network that hacked devices like wireless cameras and routers and digital recording devices and made them perform malicious tasks at their bidding? News stories like this are increasing, while at the same time, Alaskans of all ages, from tykes to college students to grandparents to small business owners, are increasing their dependence on convenient devices connected to the internet. So how do we stay safe? To answer that, we've tapped local FBI agents skilled in cybersecurity. I'd like to welcome in our studio today, Doug Klein.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Glad to have you, Doug, and also Elliot Peterson.
Hello.
So welcome to you both. We'll be talking about how to keep your home, your laptop, your desktop, your smartphone secure, and we'll also talk about how small business can keep their network safe. Your experiences and your questions on this topic are important. General questions about the FBI wouldn't be so appropriate, but specific questions on cybersecurity are. So I hope that you will call and participate in the show with us today. You can do that by calling 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'd also like to remind you that we're going to talk about a lot of resources that are available to you online to keep yourself secure. And those are listed on our website at alaskapublic.org under Hometown Alaska, so you can find them easily later. Okay, so let's get started. I told our two FBI agents that we wanted to tell people a little bit about them personally because we don't get to meet FBI agents all that often. So I wanted to say that I know Elliot Peterson because he's married to my niece, Emily, but I did not know what Elliot did. I knew he was an FBI agent, but I went to him and said, gee, I think we should do something on Hometown Alaska about being safe online. Do you know anybody would the FBI do anything about this? And so Elliot actually, turns out he works in this area. I did not know. So he agreed happily to come on. He also tapped other resources at the FBI for us, and that's how we got to Doug. So happy to have you here. One other thing I wanted to say is Elliot is homegrown, which if there's people out there thinking about careers, young people, you grew up here, went to high school. We were at Diamond. I don't know where.
Yeah, I graduated from Diamond.
And went away for a long time, but came back as an FBI agent.
Yes. Yeah. So we left and then I think spent, you know, about 10 years outside and really looked for a way to come back here. And so this was a great way to get back home.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Doug? You are not homegrown, right?
Correct.
Not here, anyway.
I've been in Alaska for a little over 8 years now.
Uh-huh. And I think you also have a wife who's an agent, right?
That is correct. My wife and I were living in Montana at the time, and she had an opportunity to get a specialty transfer to work terrorism here in Anchorage, and that's what brought us here.
So you are both in the cyber, what do you call it, the cyber unit? Is that what it's called?
The cyber squad, yes.
Yeah. And I mentioned that news story, which really caught me by surprise. It was a courtroom story about some folks around the country that were indicted. I thought you could tell us just a little bit about that because I thought people might be surprised that the Alaska FBI was doing that and why.
Sure. So we raised quite a few eyebrows, I think, finishing up our investigation into the Mirai botnet, which involved a number of young men were scattered around the country. And essentially, they had been taking what are commonly referred to as IoT or embedded devices. So small devices that are computers that have networking capability, but that just generally the public may not understand to actually be computing devices. And they harnessed all of those into a very, very powerful DDoS botnet.
So DDoS is?
DDoS being distributed denial of service, which is
denial of service, okay.
The concept of taking a lot of devices and directing their web traffic toward a single site and then overwhelming that device or site through just the sheer bandwidth that all of those devices are contributing.
Just crowd. Now, just help me with what those devices might be. Could those be garage door openers? Could they be refrigerators that are smart refrigerators? What kinds of devices are you saying that they kind of commandeered?
Sure. So in this case, the specific botnet was predominantly digital video recorders, web cameras, other devices that actually have pretty robust processors because of their ability to handle and basically video codecs was a preferred thing that this group targeted. But generally, it's good to understand that anything that can speak to the internet, your phone, your watch, your refrigerator, could be vulnerable to be used in these types of botnets. And so that's something Doug and I spent a lot of time looking at.
Mm-hmm. I was at someone's house and they had one of those Google Homes on their kitchen counter and they were talking to it. And I thought, how do you know someone isn't listening on the other end besides you just talking to it? And I don't, you know, we'll talk about that when we get into sort of, hopefully we're going to sort of arm our sort of home computer user and our small business computer user with really how to handle all this new innovation that comes along and seems so wonderful and convenient and yet might be making you a little bit vulnerable. So tell me a little bit more about why we have a cyber squad here. Does every FBI office have a cyber squad? Is that why we have one in Alaska?
Correct. We have 56 field offices with the FBI, and all 56 field offices have their own cyber squad.
And can you talk a little bit about why we, what the focus in Alaska would be, or is it the same for all across the country?
Generally speaking, each office will, I don't want to say focus on, but each office will gravitate towards whatever is greatly affecting their community. Mm-hmm. For us, it happened to be the Mirai botnet and other DDoS activities. So over the last 2 years or so, that's what Elliot and I have focused on.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the general questions I wanted to ask before we really get into home security and small business security is, I'm sure you can't be very explicit about it, but what kinds of things are you seeing? Are you looking at Alaska as well as globally? I mean, and are you seeing things in Alaska that you can talk about that alert people to the fact that it's going on here that we might never hear about?
Really, because everything we deal with involves the internet. We've kind of transitioned from that old mindset of if it happens in Alaska, it's Anchorage's responsibility. If it happens in the lower 48, Alaska doesn't touch it. With the internet, there really are no borders. So the crimes that Elliot and I are working, as long as we can somehow establish a jurisdiction, whether the actor is in Alaska or multiple victims are in Alaska, we really don't care where the crime itself is occurring, where the actors are. As long as we have some nexus that gives us jurisdiction, we have the authority to investigate it.
Go ahead, Elliot, we're going to jump in. Go ahead.
The only thing I was just going to add is we do also, though, spend a fair amount of time with the local internet service providers, so ACS or GCI. Generally, Doug and I will go there first when we see problems because they're often best equipped to, deal with the customer and inform the customer. So when we notice alarming trends or problems here in Anchorage, Alaska, that's usually our first stop to get things fixed, is to go to their internet provider and let them know what the problem is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And are you seeing things that are both affecting the home computer user as well as the small business computer user?
Oh, definitely. Especially like with the DDoS attacks. There's huge money behind DDoS attacks, whether it's an actor attacking you at your house or you at your office. So we're seeing it from the full spectrum.
And DDoS, just say that again, what it is.
Distributed denial of service attacks.
Right. And that's where also, you could be sort of offered, hey, pay us some ransom and we won't shut down your, it's that kind of thing, right?
We've seen a fair amount of that as well.
And even here in Alaska, or you can't say.
I don't recall offhand that we've had any Alaskan victims.
We've had a fair amount of ransomware, which is a separate crime scheme that certainly happened up here. DDoS extortion being the specific crime scheme in which somebody threatens or affects a DDoS attack. I don't think that we've seen that, at least not to scale up here. That's not something we've been tracking.
Tell me a little bit about ransomware and what you have seen here.
Sure. So ransomware started probably about 4 or 5 years ago. We saw it show up in the U.S. It had been happening in Europe and Australia a bit before that. And it's the idea that you will encrypt some of or all of a given computer. And encrypt mean you're going to change the underlying data so that it's not accessible or recognizable by the user, and then demanding from them some form of payment in exchange for unlocking the device. Mm-hmm. That's generally the scheme that is ransomware. And so because the privileges you need to perform a ransomware instance on somebody's computer are the same privileges you need often to do any other type of malware, it becomes a really preferred method to make money because you reliably can get a certain amount of money out of people. So maybe a given computer doesn't have a bank account or something you can target. You can still encrypt it and move on. So that's all to say that we do see people that are targeted by that. It is something that we look at quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And when we definitely work with local victims when we can. The best defense often is to have good offline backups. of your data,
your material,
and then not click attachments or hyperlinks that you don't recognize. Those are the two sort of primary infection vectors.
Mm-hmm. For ransomware.
For ransomware. Mm-hmm. And for most types of malware, mm-hmm. those are still the primary mechanisms.
So say those again. The two most common things that...
Yeah, the two best ways
links.
To sort of... Oh. Yeah, I'm sorry, the two, what we call infection vectors. So how do you get infected with a given piece of malware? Two of the most common are directly attaching those things to emails. So as PDF, as JPEGs, as Word docs,
sure.
or even often as, you know, executables. And then the second is a hyperlink, which we also call a drive-by download technique, where... An innocuous-looking link in an email actually takes you to another website that may be hosting something that we would call an exploit kit, which is a sophisticated piece of software that scans your computer for vulnerabilities, and when it finds one, pushes a payload of some type, malicious payload. And these things come and go. I mean, it seems like any given month or week, there's a different exploit kit we're looking at, pushing different payloads out.
Mm-hmm.
But you can often tell if a hyperlink's bad just by hovering your mouse over it.
Without clicking on it.
Without clicking, which depending on your mouse can be a very fine balance.
Uh-huh.
Doug and I spend a lot of time actually going with emails and looking at like the email source code if it's an HTML or putting it into text editor. You know, if you're worried about it, you can always copy it and dump it into a text editor and evaluate it.
Because the text editor will show you more than... It'll
it
show
could,
you the and, coding. Or...
Yeah, and a text editor is going to strip out the malicious portion that allows it to actually be a hyperlink.
Yes, it takes all the links out. Okay, well, those kinds of tips are what we really want to get into. I'll remind our listeners what we're talking about. We have two FBI agents in the studio today, Doug Klein and Elliot Peterson, who specialize in cybersecurity, and they're stationed here in Anchorage. And we're going to kind of do two things on the show today. We're going to talk about the home computer user, which isn't just the computer. It could be your refrigerator. It could be your wireless camera, home security camera. A lot of things that you might be employing to help yourself feel safer might be making you a little bit more vulnerable. So we'll talk about the homeowner and the home use of computers. And then after our break, we'll kind of focus in a little bit more on small business owners. Alaska has a lot of small business people. And, you know, we'd like them to get the same kind of advice. And before we leave, you know, the show at the end of the hour, we will try to give you kind of the five most important things that a homeowner should do, or a home computer user, and the five most important things that a small business owner should do, so you can walk away with some stuff that you can do. So let me throw out our phone numbers if you've got questions. You can call us in Anchorage at 550-8433. Statewide, that's 1-888-353-5752, or you can send an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so let's kind of transition into the home computer user, which isn't just the desktop and the laptop now. It's smart home, it's the Google Home, or I guess, Amazon Alexa, you know, different versions of that. Security cameras out front. I mean, I monitor, Nextdoor, and how many people have security cameras and they're watching around the clock because, you know, people are kind of alert to crime in Anchorage, but people might not realize that that's making them vulnerable. So who wants to start? And we'll kind of talk about everything from passwords, cameras. I'm even thinking about using PayPal or social media, there's something else I read about P2P, which is when you're downloading music or downloading software. There's a lot of things that you're exposing yourself to. So where's a good place to start? I think the cough is sending it over to Elliot. Okay.
Right. So Doug and I do this a lot, travel around town. We'll talk to businesses or small groups. And what we try to do is give them a sense of, hey, what are some of the things you can do that are sort of low-hanging fruit that can really improve your security posture
mm-hmm.
at home and then, you know, at work as well.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing we try to stress at home in terms of online accounts is that you need to have really strong passwords. But the thing that I think a lot of people struggle with understanding is that you also need to have unique passwords, and that's sort of a newer concept. And to explain the why behind unique passwords, and unique passwords would mean for every website I go to, I use a different password, which for some people
every
sitting at
website.
Home,
okay.
That probably sounds terrifying. But here's why. There's a lot of silent or invisible, or what we call undisclosed, breaches that happen. And that is that criminal X breaks into company Y And sometimes the information he's looking for is not actually the last four of your credit card or your billing statement or your phone number. What the criminal really just wants is your password and the email account you use to sign up on that site. Because the criminal knows that you're like most people, and that same combination unlocks the whole internet for you. And then they can quietly go around the internet testing those credentials out. So they may have got, you know, my Zappos password and discovered that I really love bright red shoes, but they're also then going to discover my Netflix account, maybe my banking account, maybe my email account.
Mm-hmm.
And so
because you've used the same password.
Because I've used the same password. And so these companies don't tell you when people are logging in from different IP addresses, and they're not going to tell you always when there's attempts on your account. It's just not necessarily in their business model. And so if you don't have a unique password for every single account, it's just a matter of time until one of them accidentally gets disclosed and all the rest of your accounts are vulnerable. And that the advice we usually often then give is that starts to be really hard, having different passwords for everything. I advocate writing them down.
I write mine down because I can't remember anything.
I don't think you've got a choice. So I think, you know, if you keep a little book, you keep it at home, I think the odds are very small that someone's going to break into your house and steal your password book.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you have to write them down, and I think they have to be long and they have to be complicated.
And they have to be unique to each site. So
they have to be unique to each site. And sometimes that could be as simple if you wanted to, of just putting the site name in your password, if that's easier, or you could find something else that works for you. But they really need to be unique. Otherwise, you're never going to know that people are hanging out in your email or your bank account.
Mm-hmm.
So individual users don't tend to have some of the same risk exposure that, say, corporate customers do. Or corporate customers, it's very easy to – I shouldn't say easy, but there's a process in place by which criminals can try to steal ACH and wire payments. For most individuals with your bank accounts, they're FDIC insured. You can't transfer big amounts of money. But your email still could be a really good launching off point for them to do other crime schemes, especially some of the business email compromise schemes we'll talk about, or the IRS tax refund fraud. And a lot of that is precipitated by a criminal having been in your personal email account for months and you didn't know.
Yeah. You know, I remember having a certified public accountant on last year related to paying your taxes, and someone had filed her income tax early, and she obviously had been compromised. I mean, she was somebody who thought, I'm too smart for this to happen to me, but it happened to her, you know. So I even actually heard people saying, you should file your taxes early this year because there's been some major breach, and this way you could get in before the criminals get in. Is that advice you think has validity, or you don't know?
That's IRS advice. We'll stay in our lane.
Let that agency deal with that. Okay. So, Elliot, could you give us, or Doug, you know, what does a good password look like?
There's a lot of debate on that. What, you know, is a really long password better than a short but very complex password? You can do the math. You can do the stats. It boils down to personal preference. What are you going to remember? What's the most difficult password that you will actually use?
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, let me add to something that Elliot said earlier.
Okay.
You know, we're sitting here recommending that you have different passwords for everything. You're never going to remember them all. Elliot suggested that you write them down. I would add to that a little bit. Rather than just writing them down, find a good password manager. It's basically a very simple to use database that stores all your passwords. It's all encrypted. That way, you know, I use a password manager. I only have to remember one. That unlocks the password manager database. From there, I type in the name of the website I want to visit. It pops up my username and my password, and then I can just copy and paste that into my web browser. That makes life a whole lot easier. It's essentially the same concept as what Elliot suggested, but it adds an extra layer of protection by encrypting those passwords. That way, you know, for example, if you, you know, Elliot's suggestion, write your password list down and leave it at home. We're all lazy. We're going to carry it with us. It's going to end up being left at your office or, you know, God forbid it falls out of your purse or your backpack somewhere.
Scary.
You know, now that's out for someone else to find.
Uh-huh.
If I accidentally drop my password manager or, you know, you somehow gain access to my computer, you know, I leave my computer unlocked and I walk away, you can jump on there. You're not going to get into the password manager unless you already know the password.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I was wondering whether it was on your home computer, whether it was vulnerable. But you're saying, no, if they don't have that password, they can't get into that password manager.
Like anything else, yes, it's vulnerable. You know, it's a matter of access. Do I have physical access to the device? That makes it quite a bit more vulnerable if I can actually touch the device.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm working remotely, then it's a matter of how often can I touch that device, or, you know, what bandwidth do I have? So what speed am I working at? Any password can eventually be defeated. It's a matter of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we get back to your original question, what is better for passwords, a really long password or a really complex password? You know, these days, I don't really think it matters that much, as long as, you know, don't do what we call keyboard walks. Don't do, you know, one, 2, 3, QWE.
Yeah.
You know, don't use your date of birth. Don't use your spouse's name. Don't use your dog's name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make it something that you will definitely remember. But, you know, I know a lot about Elliot. He should not pick anything that involves, you know, shooting guns or cyber, or I will guess his password fairly quickly.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, pick something that you will remember, but that no one else will directly associate
okay.
with you.
I have ideas. Yeah, I can think of some of mine that are good. No one would ever guess, and others that are so obvious, I'm embarrassed to be talking about it, you know, like my dog. So let's see. I wondered about things like the cloud. And people might be storing a lot of things in the cloud. How secure is that? And either one or both?
I think what that does is take us really neatly into the second thing that becomes really important to do, which is two-factor authentication. And if you're
right.
not familiar with two-factor authentication,
mm-hmm.
it's the idea that you have a password or phrase, something you know, and then you have something that's relatively variable. So it could be that Google texts a number to your cell phone and you use that number to complete the login. It could be a changing variable that you carry with you on your phone or in an actual physical token. Two-factor, especially when you start dealing with cloud or web-based email or things that everybody can access that are really important, is essential. And we recommend absolutely your personal email account, whatever you use primary, the email that's got every secret you've ever had for the last 10 years, that has to be locked down with two-factor. And every email provider these days makes that really easy to do. You can find steps or YouTube videos. It's usually 3 or 4 clicks, and then they send you a text. And a lot of people say, well, I don't want to do this every time. Most of the services will remember the computer you're on or give you a month or two before you've got to reset it. So
mm-hmm.
it's absolutely worth the inconvenience. Two factors, one of the only ways you can ensure with a high degree of success that there's not somebody else in your email. So
mm-hmm.
if you're listening and you don't have two-factor on your primary email, please, please, please go ahead and do that. And then your bank accounts, anything dealing with financial or payment, especially when you start talking about cloud and online banking, you should do two-factor. And if your bank doesn't support two-factor, then you need to talk to your bank about how
mm-hmm.
they need
My
to implement
does.
That.
My bank does, yeah, yeah, yeah.
yeah.
What about all the sites that let you sign on with your Facebook? Is that are you more vulnerable there? Because Facebook's – certainly I get emails from people I know that somehow their Facebook seems to have been compromised. I don't know for sure, but
right. No, I mean, it's something certainly I don't like, and it's something I don't like, and it's what it really amounts to. It's a way for Facebook and the other websites to track and associate content with you across the web. So, some people really prefer it for convenience. Certainly, it's not anything that I do or would recommend if you can help it. But you know, you'll also find a lot of people that use the same email to sign up for every different service,
yeah.
and the password that actually unlocks that email is the same password they're using signing up for each of those services. So you can create this sort of rolling effect, like we were explaining, where once somebody gets into one thing, they could potentially be into everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and we did mention these security cameras, and it made me think about routers, because I guess everything is going to go through the router. So what, again, is there two-step authentication for routers, or how would you make sure that your security camera isn't telling the world more about you than you realize, or, you know?
Most of the routers most of the consumer-grade routers that you're going to find at, say, Best Buy or, you know, any of the big box stores, they're not going to have that two-factor authentication built in because they're not designed to be employed in a hostile environment. They're designed to be employed within the deployed within the security of your own home. In theory, you trust everyone within your home who's going to be connecting to that router. So you're really more concerned with protecting that router from the outside world. So obviously the first thing I would recommend is the second you get that router online, change the password. Unfortunately, manufacturers use very poor security when they develop these routers, and they're all sent out with the administrator username is admin, and the password is password, or, you know, it's admin.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, most home users don't think about these sorts of things.
As being a vulnerability.
Being a vulnerability. But the bad guys know very well the default password setups for virtually any router that's available at any, you know, even at Amazon. You know, it doesn't matter how wide a variety you have available to you. The bad guys are going to know what the default username and password is. So by all means, your first step should be to change that. You know, at the same time, as you're setting up that router, unfortunately, a lot of these home routers are designed to make your life easy. So they come with services such as Telnet or...
Telnet.
And okay. Secure Shell access. Those are just ways of remotely accessing a computer. So these home routers, to make your life easy, a lot of them will come with Telnet and SSH enabled by default. For someone like me, that's not an issue because, you know, I know to look for that. I know how to lock that down and prevent that from happening. For someone like my parents, they've probably had Telnet and SSH open for the last 15 years and still don't know about it.
Wow. So did you tell us enough that people would know how to deal with that? Or
I think if I could say one concept Doug's describing, I think is really helpful for people to understand, is this idea of the architecture you have in your computer network at home.
Mm-hmm.
In all of our homes, most of us now have 10 to 20 computers easily when mm-hmm. you think about what devices are in the house.
iPads,
and connect to the internet.
In the kitchen, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So broadly speaking, the only device that's really vulnerable all the time is whatever the public-facing device is. So most people, where they're set up at home, a company is providing internet to the house. That's coming through a cable box the company provides that may or may not in itself be a Wi-Fi or router modem. And then usually that device, if they're not using the company's devices, let's say their Wi-Fi router, they have a Wi-Fi router connected to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a normal architecture. And in that scenario, it's either that cable company's device that is the public-facing device that's most vulnerable, or it's what we would call the next-in-line device, which would be their modem at home. The danger in what we see with a lot of these botnets is sometimes people will take devices like a web security camera and hook it directly up to the internet. And in that case, that device was never really made to be it's not a standalone security device. It's designed, as Doug was saying, for convenience. So generally, if a person at home has got the same Wi-Fi router they've had for the last 5 or 6 years, it's time to go to Best Buy and it's time to invest in a new router that supports higher security standards. That's
mm-hmm.
You know, Doug and I prefer routers that have something called DDWRT, which is an open source router security software. Because a lot of times people are running around with old routers that have known vulnerabilities, which we see pretty regularly targeted even here in Alaska.
So 5 to 6 years old, it's time to upgrade or just get a new one.
I think 5 to 6 is reasonable. Yeah. When you look at the money invested in it, I think 5 to 6 is reasonable. If you're trying to keep up with the pace of technology, maybe 1 to 2, but...
Not everybody can do that.
The cost benefit of that, you know, that's a personal decision.
Right. Wow. I'm just running through my list here of things I thought about. PayPal, we talked a little bit about that. I don't know if that's got double authentication or not.
And I would definitely recommend. I mean, PayPal, if you're using PayPal regularly, if you're sending money, should have a hard password and definitely something to consider doing two-factor authentication on.
Okay. Let's see. We talked a little bit about P2P networks, music and software downloads. Trojans get installed, hacker comes back later. Is that anything you're seeing? or is there...
All of that, yes.
All of the time.
We are seeing peer-to-peer Trojans. We see that file sharing, you know, is a common way to distribute malware because you can't often take the steps you need to authenticate what you're actually downloading.
Mm-hmm.
It's very common for people to put malicious files on file sharing and call it maybe a really, you know, it's Taylor Swift's Reputation album and you download it and it is not. It is something else entirely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That can be pretty common. We get asked a lot, should I run antivirus? I've heard antivirus doesn't work very well. What's the best antivirus? We absolutely recommend you run antivirus. One of the things criminals have done the last couple years is they will often change malware so that it's unrecognizable to antivirus, maybe initially, but the antivirus will still pick it up. So some people have said, well, antivirus doesn't work to catch things all the time, so I'm just not going to use it. And that's great, and that's how you end up infected with something for 5 or 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So we recommend antivirus. There's a number of great antivirus products. I think you've got a link to the CERT website, and
mm-hmm.
I think there's a few that they recommend.
We do. Yeah.
And then, you know, if you're running a Windows system, for example, you know, run Defender and run the updates. A lot of people don't continue to update their computers. And generally, we will see a public disclosure of a vulnerability, and it's often a matter of just hours, if not days, before there are viruses or trojans that are exploiting that vulnerability. So if you're not setting your computer up to do regular updates, mm-hmm. you can have problems.
Mm-hmm. You're scaring me. Okay. That's okay. That's good to be scared a little bit. So we're going to take a little break. If you were sort of listening in the last couple minutes and wondering what this is, we've got two FBI agents here who are experts in cybersecurity. We've been talking about how to make your home more secure. After the break, we're going to come back and talk a little bit about small businesses and maybe mobile devices, actually. We should probably touch on that. And toward the end, we really want to leave you with the five things you really need to do. So even if there's been a lot of discussion here that's overwhelming, or, you know, you should be able to walk away from today's show knowing a couple of things you can do to make yourself more safe. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'd like to welcome back our two FBI agents who are specialists in cybersecurity. We've got Doug Klein. Welcome back, Doug.
Thank you.
And Elliot Peterson. And let's see, we wanted to sort of move into the small business owner. It's not really the same as the home computer user. There's some other interactions with customers and things like that that Mike, I know less about that because I'm not a small business owner. So I'm going to sort of toss the ball out there and say, what are some of the important things that things I think about are somebody inside the company that's, maybe selling information, but credit card identity theft, denial of service attacks. Anyway, so what's a good way to proceed here for small business owners?
You know, a lot of what we've been talking about for the home user also applies to the small business user. It's just a matter of scale.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the tips we gave you on the routers and the home Wi-Fi networks, that all applies as well. You're just talking about a larger scale, more users, more complexity, more time needs to be spent ensuring best practices for passwords, you know, password complexity, password rotation, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And maybe who all knows the passwords
exactly
at your company. How about you, Elliot? What do you have to add?
I think the primary difference, and Doug's absolutely right, the primary difference becomes you now have something of interest to all criminals, which is money. So when you move into small, medium businesses and then high net worth individuals, you suddenly have money and you have a mechanism to move money because most small businesses send electronic payments. And in the U.S., the two principal methods for that are ACH payments and SWIFT wire payments.
What's HCA?
ACH is Automated Clearinghouse, I believe is the acronym, but that's a bank term of just basically like a person-to-person or account-to-account payment. And so many small businesses are able to send pretty large amounts, I mean, into the millions, and even in some routinely do, depending on their business. You know, businesses involved in like oil and gas can send millions of dollars and receive millions of dollars a day just because of high commodity prices.
Mm-hmm.
And so the criminals are interested in that, and the criminals are looking to access those accounts, and they have very, very sophisticated means to do what we call man-in-the-middle and targeted attacks. And so we recommend that small businesses think hard about the computers and the individuals that are able to send those payments. And we recommend that they use two-factor authentication for those accounts and that they minimize, to the extent they can, personal or business email usage on the computers that are going to be the primary payment computers, because that helps avoid the risk of getting infected. So because most malware and virus infections come via email and payloads that are attached to emails and spam and things like that, if you can minimize the amount of that that's happening, let's say, on your primary machine you use to pay bills, you've got less exposure. Usually with banks, you can also set up so there's two payees. So you might have somebody that can initiate the payment and somebody that can approve the payment, but one person can't do both things. So if the business is of the right size, that can really help. And then one of the other things that Doug and I recommend is try to get callbacks set up with your bank. So, you know, if you are routinely sending wires below 50,000 but not above 50,000, then you could ask your bank to call you anytime you try to initiate a payment over 50,000 just to confirm that you really wanted that payment to go out the door. And that helps a lot with everything except business email compromise, which has been a relatively severe trend.
Describe that a little bit. What's business email compromise?
So essentially, the business email compromise is where you get an email from someone purported to be your boss saying, you know, hey, I'm out of town right now. I need this payment to be made. Please wire X amount of dollars to this account.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really busy, so don't bother me. Just take my word. It's really me. You know, that sort of thing.
Red flags are going off.
Unfortunately, you know, I joke about it, but the guys writing these emails, doing the business email compromises, have gotten very, very good.
Uh-huh.
And they are using language that is pretty hard to detect these days that it is a fraud.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, the person receiving these emails, they really have to be on their toes and know what to look for.
Hmm.
So it's really not easy to detect. That's why, you know, Elliot recommended having the bank do a callback.
Yeah.
You know, another thing we recommend is put mechanisms in place where your bosses do not make requests for payment via email. They do that in person. Or even do a form of two-factor authentication where if I call the bank and tell them to transfer money, the bank has half the key. They now need to wait for Elliot to call and confirm that we really do want to transfer that money. So you have two employees from your payroll department or from your finance department that both have to approve a payment before it can go through.
Okay. That's good. That's really good.
If you're a small business owner, the head of a small business, I mean, our recommendation is today talk to your staff and let them know that you will never ask for a wire ACH payment over email. You will always call them so they can do voice recognition. And we're not seeing really well spoofed phone calls right now. We are seeing, as Doug mentioned, really well spoofed emails. And in some cases, we're even seeing where they're in the CEO's email. That's very common up here in Alaska. The CEO doesn't know. They've been in their email for months because they've got their password thanks to the Zappos fictional brief breach. And so you need the C-suite, you know, CEO, presidents, CFOs to go talk to people that have the ability to send these payments and tell them that they will never, ever request it via email. And then you're good until you hire a new employee because they'll recognize it. But if you haven't had that conversation with them and you've got a good employee, then you know they're trying to do the right thing by sending these wires. And generally the problem with BEC type schemes is we don't learn about the fraud because we're not notified or the local police aren't notified until days after the money went out because it just came in via email.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas oftentimes with the more sophisticated methods, and we can learn about that more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
There's more indicators of fraud when some of the rest of that happens.
And Elliot just brought up a point that I wanted to make, you know, talking about password reuse. You know, some external site gets compromised and they obtain your username and password. Because we're creatures of habit, odds are good I'm probably using the same username and password back at work. So now the bad guy has all the tools needed to essentially monitor my work email for several weeks or months. And we see the emails where the business email compromise, the email itself, is written in the exact same language as the CEO would use.
Oh,
and that email,
he's been reading the CEO's email.
Because he's been reading the CEO's email, the bad guy even knows that the CEO's on vacation down in Seattle or wherever. He knows the dates. He knows the flight numbers.
Hmm.
And the bad guy can time that email, you know, hey, I'm running late for my flight. I'm supposed to take off in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Don't bother me with this. Just get it done.
Yeah. So. I want to throw out our phone numbers for folks one more time. And we do have a couple of emails coming in, some of which we sort of answered, but some might not. The number in Anchorage, if you'd like to call us, is 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And of course, we welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. We have a question. Would you please discuss VPNs as internet browsers? Okay, that was a question that came in. How about that?
Okay, that is actually something that Elliot and I had talked about bringing up during the break. So essentially a VPN it stands for a virtual private network. That encrypts traffic from, say, for example, I run a VPN on my personal cell phone. I've got it running 24/7. Any data leaving my cell phone is encrypted from my phone back to the server operated by the VPN company. That data, when it hits the VPN server, it is then decrypted and sent to wherever my original traffic was going, whether that's a website or an email or whatever.
To your wife or something like
exactly.
that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Exactly. So the main reason to use the VPN is to encrypt traffic until it gets out of your phone and off your local network, I guess, would be the easiest way. There's this misconception that the VPN traffic is fully encrypted from point to point. That's not the case. It's encrypted for the first 50% of the outbound route and for the last 50% of the inbound route.
Oh.
But the beauty of that is if you're at Kaladi Brothers on their Wi-Fi, it would be very trivial for someone skilled with computers such as Elliot to sit there and monitor you on the other side of the restaurant or the coffee shop to monitor your internet habits and to siphon out your email or to figure out what websites you're going to. If you're on a VPN, no one else within the coffee shop is going to have a clue what you're doing. Mm-hmm. They will know you're on the computer. They will know you're sending and receiving traffic. They will have no idea what the contents of that traffic are.
Okay. Let me get to another question, if I may. I regularly get a call from someone with a foreign accent that tells me that my Windows computer is infected with a virus and I need to follow their instructions to get the virus cleared. It seems like they want me to add some coding to my computer. I usually hang up on them, but they are obviously getting some people to fall for this. Is there anything that can be done to get this sort of thing stopped, says Gail. Well, what do you say?
I think I would tell Gail that sounds very legitimate. it's something we call fake AV, fake antivirus, and it's really common. They can be really successful. Anytime they're getting the call, I mean, we always say ask for a callback number. A foreign accent is a great indication. They'll usually sound British because the places we see doing this are usually places that speak the Queen's English, so West Africa commonly, India. And this stuff is spreading, and they're really convincing. So, no, anytime you get a call and anybody's asking to put anything on your computer, don't. It's going to be some sort of remote access Trojan or other tool that allows them to access their computer. They're going to put malware on your computer, and they're going to probably try to extort you or sell you access to something. Mm-hmm. So get Hang a callback on. Number if you think it's legitimate or absolutely, hang up is the first bet. And similarly, when you get calls about bank accounts, that started to happen up here too. When you get a call and it's somebody saying we have a message or we want to tell you something about your Alaska USA or whatever account, always hang up. Those aren't real calls. Never provide your account information or credit card number because that's often what they say. Enter your credit card number and we'll give you this message. It's just an automated scheme to try to do what's called scraping, which is they're trying to generate this account information so they can go and perpetrate fraud against you.
Hmm. And we see a lot of emails, the same thing, preying on your fear. You know, we saw some unusual activity on your credit card. If you don't respond within 4 hours, we're going to close your account.
Right.
Odds are good that's going to be fake. Okay. Whether it's the scenario I proposed or the example that Elliot just gave, if you have any questions, hang up. Delete the email. Run to your bank.
Mm-hmm. Talk directly to your bank.
Talk to the teller. Tell them what's going on. Uh-huh. 9 times out of 10, they're going to tell you everything's fine. You've wasted your time coming down here, but you have that reassurance. You got out of the office for a few minutes. Life is good.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to go ahead and take a call if I can. I'd like to welcome Elias onto Hometown Alaska. What's your question, Elias? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Elias.
Hello.
Go ahead with your question.
I'd like to know how much risk I'm putting myself at by playing Agario, a game on your cell phone.
Okay. What do you think?
I'm not familiar with that specific game, so I can't necessarily answer. My best advice would be whether it's, whether you're getting that from the Apple Store or the Google Play Store, look at the reviews. A lot of times the reviews have some pretty good insights as to what you can expect. If it's a game that only has, 10 or 15 reviews, that might be a little suspicious. If there's hundreds of thousands and they're all negative, you might want to pay attention to that. If they're all highly positive, then that may be an indication. You know, I mean, it's not a definitive indication, but that may give you some indication as to how much trust you should place into that game.
Yeah, I think to echo that, if you're getting a game out of the Play Store and out of Apple, you know, out of iTunes, whatever else, you're doing the best possible thing in terms of your security. They've vetted those. It's very rarely that we see anything malicious make it into those stores. You also should pay attention to the privileges a given application is asking for on your phone. So when you see a phone that looks like it does something simple, but it tells you it needs your location and contact list and a bunch of other things, be very suspicious. We're starting to see a trend of that with free apps. And what can happen is once you've given those privileges over to that application, it can take all of that information constantly and send it back to servers and you'll never see it. So we say be very cautious of apps that seem to ask for far more privileges than they need, because you never know where that data is going. And a lot of times one application running on your phone can get as much important information about you as, say, a place like Apple or Google would have, and they're the device manufacturer.
Okay. I'm going to take one more caller. I'd like to welcome Carrie to Hometown Alaska. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay. I have a similar question to the email one, where I get a daily, almost daily call from someone saying they're from Windows Tech. And it happens usually when I just turn my computer on. And I used to hang up, but now I kind of engage them in conversation and asking them, you know, what kind of computer I have and what could be the problem. And in one conversation, he actually gave me what he says is my license number. So is that something, is that my Windows license number, or what is that? I mean, they have my name, they have my telephone number, and then he has this license number.
So the number he's likely referring to, Carrie, would be your Windows license ID number. So whenever you install a version of Microsoft Windows, there's a unique identifier that's tracked, and you'd be able to look that up. I don't know which operating system. I think you said Windows 10. So if you use...
No, actually, I'm on Windows 7, which they say is bad because they're not doing any updates anymore for Windows 7.
They have, and I think they've got a free update that'll roll you to 8.1 if you're interested. I think that as part of their end of life, they'll get you at least into the Microsoft 8 if you're interested. So he's likely referring to your you know, whatever Microsoft uses as a, 20, 30 character number. You could check that. I would certainly be concerned enough to think that it's worth probably maybe backing up some of your important files and running one, if not more than one, antivirus products on your system, because it could very well be that for some reason there's a remote access tool installed on your machine that gives them visibility into that. If they're calling you whenever you're turning your computer on, I find that to be pretty suspicious.
I did too, and they've left me alone for the holidays, so they haven't called for a couple of weeks now. But anyway, I have a Norton security system that runs checks regularly.
Okay.
And they ask me to turn my computer on, and they want me to do something, which I haven't ever done. But I just thought it was interesting that he cited off this.
Yes, so you could check that against your actual license key and see if that matches and then be really alarmed. But I think you're hearing enough to probably, if you know, you can run something other than Norton as well. I mean, if it's been going on this long, I would expect Norton to detect it. That's a pretty good antivirus system. But I might try backing things up and either reinstalling to a more updated version of Windows, or if you want to go back to the original Microsoft 7 and maybe just do a clean install and see if you still get phone calls after that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Carrie. Here's one. I think we may have answered it. It was, shouldn't the firewalls and home routers protect devices connected to them, or are these being hacked first, either through default passwords, backdoors, or unpatched vulnerabilities? I think we talked about cameras that you hook up directly to the internet instead of through your router. So the routers would be protecting you to a certain extent.
To a certain extent, yes. As long as you're plugging the devices on the proper side of the router, as long as the devices are going through the router, then in theory, yes, they are protected by the firewall. However, that goes back to the conversation we had earlier about the consumer-grade routers that you're buying these days. The firewalls on them they're better than nothing, but they're really not tuned to your environment. They are configured so that 99% of the people who walk into the store and buy that router can plug it in and do nothing to it, and it'll work fine.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really designed for your utmost safety.
Mm-hmm.
They're designed for the utmost convenience, not safety.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be holes in those firewalls. One of the common things that we're seeing with home routers these days is called universal plug and play. Essentially, it makes it very easy for you to attach a USB hard drive to your Wi-Fi router. Now you have your own version of cloud storage. Well, universal plug and play is very easy to compromise. Because the router comes with the universal plug and play enabled by default, there's a hole in your firewall. It is now fairly trivial for me to get inside your firewall and access all the other things that you think are protected.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have another question here. I understand Kaspersky security software is from Russians and that the U.S. government banned its use on government computers. Is it safe to use? Do you know anything about that?
We have no comment, but there are some interesting news articles that came out recently discussing Kaspersky and the potential behavior of the malware on systems.
So you might be careful? Would it be safe to say that, or you don't even know?
I would be careful with any virus or any security product that you invest in. I would do your own research and due diligence and find a product that you're comfortable with.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Are there areas we haven't touched on? We talked about mobile phones and thinking a little bit about people going to coffee shops or libraries or airports and not. I essentially turn off my Wi-Fi and I use cellular data there. Is that a safer thing to do on a public domain?
I agree. That's what I would recommend to my family as well. If you're going to be out at a restaurant, a coffee shop, in the mall, whatever, avoid the free Wi-Fi. You know, you're probably not going to be using so much cellular data that you need to worry about running up your bill. there's just too many risks with the local Wi-Fi. If you can run off cellular, there's so many for example, I'm on AT&T. There are so many AT&T users here in Anchorage that my traffic just kind of hides in the midst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm running a VPN anyhow, so even better. But, you know, the traffic is so heavily intermingled with all the other AT&T users throughout the city that it would be very difficult to target and track a specific ID.
Mm-hmm.
So by all means, if you have the choice between Wi-Fi or cellular, I would go with the VPN, in which point I don't care which you use. If you don't have a VPN, the cellular would afford you a little more security.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Elliot?
I think one of the things we get asked a lot is about safety on the internet in terms of children. And so some of the best practices we recommend are things like disabling autoplay, especially with video services, because if you don't disable autoplay, you know, you can leave the room, the kids are watching Care Bears and come back and they're watching clips from Aliens 3 or something, right?
So something scary.
Yeah. So yes. You have to be careful with that. We also recommend enabling the content restrictions. So where you can put an age bracket in place, do put an age bracket in place that can really prevent them from getting access to content that you really wouldn't want them to see. Put computers in a public place, especially for young children. If they're going to be using the computer, we recommend, you know, kitchen, living room, just somewhere where they can get used to the computer and the internet around you. And then remember that a lot of devices you don't think of as computers are actually computers. So, you know, modern iPods, iPads, I mean, even an iPod, you can put texting software on that and make phone calls and send people SMS messages and videos and pictures. So there's a lot of devices in your house, Kindles, et cetera, that really are computers.
That you're not thinking about.
And, to take that even a step further, these days, doorbells are Wi-Fi enabled. Coffee makers are Wi-Fi enabled. I have a smoker that has Wi-Fi.
You mean like for smoking fish?
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, just because it doesn't look like a computer, it very well may have Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And these days, it probably does have Wi-Fi.
Yeah. And in general, all those devices are going through your router, and you're going to upgrade your router.
Hopefully, yes.
I've got another question here. It's a mobile device security question. Sometimes on my cell phone, a message suddenly comes through telling me I've won a prize or making an offer of a deal. Just yesterday, I got an offer for a $1,000 gift certificate on Amazon. Sometimes this happens when I'm visiting a website on my phone's browser, but sometimes it just shows up. My practice is to shut down my phone immediately, since usually there's no close button on these offers. What's the best practice?
So a couple things can contribute. One on the computer is to have a pop-up blocker. We very much recommend you run pop-up blockers and that you try to use the maximum security settings in your browsers. And then always ignore those messages. I mean, in any sort of prize you've won, lottery you've won, well-paying work-from-home scheme, at worst, you're going to lose all your money. At really worst, you're going to get arrested because you're participating in some crazy Ponzi scheme. So generally speaking, there's no one out there looking to pay you a whole bunch of money to sit around in your bathrobe and you know, take money in and out of your bank account.
Right. By the way, we got an email from a fellow who says extended support, which includes security updates for Windows 7, it lasts until January 2020. So you were talking about that, Elliot, that you can, even if you've got an old Windows, they're offering an end of life thing. So I promised listeners that we would try to give them the five most important things to do, both from the home user's perspective and from the small business. What do you think? I mean, I think we're going to reiterate some of what we've talked about. What would you be your top things for small business?
Small business or home user, change your password. Anytime you get a new device, change the
same
default.
Same for both, basically, right?
I don't care where you are. If you're deploying a device on the internet, change the default password.
And roughly like every 3 months?
I would recommend, kind of the industry standard is recycle or to change passwords every 60 to 90 days.
Okay.
And I think for businesses especially, that's really important. I don't know at home. I do it more than like a year. You know, I try to force myself on the new year, new email password, new bank password, make sure they're different. Mm-hmm. But when you start getting into that business environment, it becomes really important to roll those passwords regularly, because if you don't and you're not doing two-factor, that can be your only indication of a compromise. Two-factor of your primary email. Hopefully everyone listening has already done that.
We said it's two or three clicks and they can have it done, right?
Take that a step further. Two-factor authentication for anything that involves money, whether that's your bank account, your investment accounts, your Amazon shopping account. If you can make money from it or spend money at that site, figure out how to get two-factor authentication.
What about, you know, people who have, say, maybe have some stock and they're going to the website to see how their stock's doing, and there's not double authentication? Is that, I mean, financial houses you would think would be really alert to this.
Right. So I think you can go view stock prices without being concerned. But I think if you have a brokerage or trading account, definitely would recommend two-factor. We haven't seen those maybe as aggressively targeted, because often you can only move money back into the account that you're feeding into those. But certainly, if I had brokerage accounts, they would be locked down with two-factor authentication.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good thing. Okay, so have we gotten to five yet? That we have about 30 seconds or so.
Keep your computer updated.
Update. Okay,
run
all the software updates.
Product. And then make sure that, especially if you've got an older router at home, your Wi-Fi router, that you go get a good new secure one. Doug and I recommend routers that support the DDWRT protocol.
Say that again, DDWRT.
RT.
Routers. Okay, that support that protocol.
Yes.
Okay, I told you guys when you hear the music, we're really out of time. So, gosh, this was a really good show, and I think we answered a lot of good questions for people. I really appreciate all this. So I'd like to thank Elliot Peterson and Doug Klein from the FBI. Charles Wolforth will be back as your host on the next Hometown Alaska, and he's going to talk about dream vacations for 2018. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska, and drive safe.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.